In your Bibles, turn to Proverbs chapter 3. We last week started this section, and we're doing a study on Proverbs. It's kind of fun this morning. I saw Melinda standing in the doorway. And it was one of those times when you see somebody, you go, I know them, but I can't place where I know them from, you know? And her children at Saks when I was there, we got, so this was years ago, and Gail, you know, there we got, make connection. They're up from San Antonio and living in the area. So that's the kind of, when you recognize somebody that's good. I've had times I recognize somebody and I can't figure out where in the world, we never can place it. Or when I was in Raleigh, North Carolina, I had, unbeknownst to me, I looked like Roy Williams, who coached the Tar Heels, his twin brother. And there were times we'd be in a restaurant and people would come over and say, I know you. And I'm going, no, you really don't. No, I do. I know you. Like, no, I'm not who you think I am. No, can I have your autograph? And I'd have to say, I'm not Roy Williams. That isn't who I am.
That's when you sell it for the dinner.
Yes, yes. Yeah, if they would pay for my dinner, that would be great. Or my kids in the car would say, Dad, the people in the car next to us are looking at us again. So, you know, it's like, so anyway. So welcome. Glad to have you here this morning. So Proverbs chapter 3, just a couple things from last week that I want to just remind us that Proverbs, when we're studying wisdom, we're coming at it with the understanding that wisdom is a study of how to skillfully apply God's truth. That's what it's all about. To know God, to love Him, to love His Word, and then to understand how to skillfully apply it. The other thing is, Proverbs is not a study of devotion. It's not a devotional like the Psalms. And it's not historical, giving us the nature and character of God, of how He interacts with individuals. Proverbs focuses in on how we live a holy, godly, wise life until God returns. It's very applicable, very practical. And so that's what we're doing. I know it's this was last week. I just don't know if any of you needed to see that again. You know, that's number 7 grandchild, if you needed to see that again. So you're doing great. Eyes are open and all is well. So we're in Proverbs 3, 7. We kind of picked up Proverbs 3, 1 through 6, which many of you probably recognize that real central passage, you know, in all your ways acknowledge Him and He will direct your paths and make them straight. So we're going to pick up 7 through 12, and 7 through 12, as he's gone through this element of wisdom, its value, and not leaning. We talked about how you don't lean on your own understanding and what that looks like. He then goes into what I would call 3 exhortations with good reasons, and he just hits them right away, 3 things. And I do think if we look at Proverbs, we're going to find that Solomon has every now and then what you might call a power punch, you know. You're hearing some things, he's reading, and then all of a sudden he'll just hit a home run. He'll hit something that really hits home with us. And it can be different passages. So in this one, as he's coming in and talking to his son and giving him direction, he's going to give us 3 exhortations, and he's going to tell you the reason why it's important. So I'm going to read, if I can find it here quickly, we're going to read Proverbs chapter 3, verses 7 through 12. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It will be healing to your body and refreshment to your bones. Honor the Lord from your wealth and from the first of all your produce, so your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. My son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord or loathe His reproof. For whom the Lord loves, He reproves, even as a father corrects the son whom he delights. So looking at this passage, one of the things I recognized as I was studying it, I think 7 is really connected also to 5 and 6. And the reason I say that is because 5 and 6 says, don't lean on your own understanding, but acknowledge God in all things. Well, what would be the contrast or the element of what it means to lean on your own understanding? It would mean thinking you're wise enough to make the decisions. Okay? So wisdom comes from the Lord's counsel, the Lord's precepts, and here he's encouraging, don't lean on your own understanding. And then he says, don't be wise in your own eyes. So it's almost as if a simple individual recognizes, okay, I shouldn't lean on my own understanding. And the prideful individual is now here challenged, don't be too wise in your own eyes. Have any of us at any point kind of felt like we've run into an individual or we personally find somebody who, based on their worldview, it centers around themselves and their wisdom centers around themselves, and their evaluation of the world, they feel that they're the ones that have the right answers. They're the ones that are wise for the situation. And we find they're not as wise as they think they are. The key thing of Proverbs is that if wisdom is formed and founded in the individual, it will be flawed. It's got to be formed and founded in God's precepts and His principles. And remember from the first we studied, we can see and recognize those from simply looking at how the world operates. We can recognize good, evil. We can recognize the benefits of good generally and the downfall of evil generally, because we have to recognize, and I would point to Ecclesiastes, where there are times when we see somebody evil, and from what we see on the outside, we think they're prospering. But Proverbs is going to lean to the effect, to the idea that the outward appearance of prosperity is not what we're striving for. There's an inner quality that should be what we grasp and value. Okay? So let's look at this first precept. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Do fear God and turn from evil. And his reason, he says, the value of this is it's going to be, it's heal your body and refreshing to your bones. Now, if you're a believer and have been a believer a while and you strive to understand God's word and you strive to live it, I know from my own personal experience, I know that at times when I'm living in that, even when it's difficult around me, there's a peace that I possess, there's a tranquility that I possess, there's a sense within me that I feel better. And the other component we mentioned last week is scientifically we recognize that when we trust ourselves and there is stress around us and we rely on ourselves completely, there are physical attributes that display it in our life. High blood pressure potentially, other elements. He is pointing to the fact, I believe, that he, even back then when they didn't have the stress meters and the blood pressure cuffs and the doctors with the medicine and all, there was a recognition that living with God first, fearing the Lord, not trusting myself, looking at the world through that paradigm, that there was a healthy component to that. That my physical body benefited from not relying on my own wisdom. That as I looked at life and I lived it, I trusted, those who trust God would find refreshment to the bones. Now, why would he use the term bones? Well, it's the structure and health and well-being of the inner body. He's used the heart before, which is the heart is more the idea and values, and the bones is more the physical component. He is linking a physical well-being component to living wisely, that we will physically experience that. Let me give just a minute. Anybody want to share something on this concept, this principle of not being wise in your own eyes and the sense of a physical well-being of your own?
Well, I mean, I could, you know, the converse is true. If you maybe participate in a conversation you shouldn't have or saw something you shouldn't have, the rottenness that you feel.
Yeah, okay.
After that, oh man, why did I participate in that gossip or that storytelling, that I should just recuse myself of that?
So yeah.
The opposite is definitely very, very clear.
If there's anyone who has studied the physical side of it, if I'm not mistaken, I think studies have shown that a person who possesses guilt finds it displayed in the physical body. Is that, I mean, anybody done any research or on that that can contribute? Just give you an opportunity.
As a retired nurse, what we would see is somebody that deals with stress, constant stress. It does impact the your overall well-being. Mm-hmm. Essential hypertension, a lot of times that is, you know, poor just mental health.
And the idea is that tends to shorten your life. You know, the ailment. There's a book that I read when I was in college. It was called None of These Diseases. And we read it as a science class, which is the treatise of the author was primarily on the mental ideas of how you view things and everything often shows up in the physical ailments that you have. And that if you were if you were able to treat the area that was frustrating or the component within the brain, you know, not brain, but the way they were viewing life, that sometimes you would see a direct result of the physical body improving. Okay? So that the first exhortation is don't be wise in your own eyes. And I want to encourage you to realize that his primary thing is don't develop a system of wisdom that you believe is your own, and without relying on the Lord's wisdom, without relying on his precepts. So don't be wise in your own eyes. Don't make yourself the center of what defines good, evil, wisdom, and so forth. Second treatise is in verse 9, where he says, do honor God with your wealth from the first of your produce. The reason, your barns will be full and your vats of new wine will be full. Couple comments on this. First, I want to talk about the positive element that I see here and then the negative element, okay, and how you translate this. The positive element here is an understanding that wealth comes from the Lord. What you have is given to you by the Lord. Now, this morning as I was driving and thinking on this, I was thinking about ancient civilizations, even those that didn't recognize Yahweh or give him honor. Even those civilizations in the creation of the world and the structure and what they knew inside was that there was a power greater than them, and there was some response due, proper response due, in order for me to see the crops grow regularly. They would see the seasons. And they really relied on those seasons. There was a growing time, there was a harvesting time, and they really believed there was a power outside. They gave it different names, they qualified gods for all different things. But what we should recognize is that in the creation of the world, in man, he is aware that he's reliant on something larger than him for his sustenance. And so Proverbs recognizes that. We recognize that Yahweh created the earth, created the world with its seasons, and man is relying on him to provide his nourishment. And when he says here, there is an element of honor due God in your wealth or in your possessions, and that you should be honoring him. And it is not, or I should say it's consistent in Scripture, that this honoring is some recognition with the very first fruits of what I get. It's a way of saying, in the first element of the harvest, that first crop that I take in, I'm to donate it. I'm to give it to the church. I'm to use it as a tithe. We can use terms like that. He is stating that in whatever I do with what I'm provided with, I should recognize and honor God with that, whatever that is. So the principle for us today is that no matter what element of wealth that you have, no matter what you possess, a recognition of God's provision, and to recognize there should be an honoring of that with the first fruits. That's how the Proverbs presents it. Yes, sir?
I think it's in context, it's not only the dollar wealth you have, but it's the health that you have. The ability to give people not only the money, but to give people your time, which they also need even more than they do the dollar.
Yeah. And I would propose, if you will, this is the other side of it. I propose the illustrations that he uses here are intentional, and they are directly related to your physical sustaining. It is crops. It is wine. This is not ornamental wealth that he's talking about. This is not jewelry. This is not stone. He doesn't point to those. He points to the very things that sustain us in life. So if we have abundance in food, then yes, I can, and that comes later in the text about caring for others. But we should not look at this and say it is related to our luxury and our abundance. That's not the context. I believe the context here is that that annual sustaining of the Lord through crops and food, we are to recognize it comes from Him. We are to honor Him with the first fruits. And the promise is, if you continue to do that, your barns will be full. You'll have food. You'll have enough to sustain you and more. The error becomes, in my opinion, the error becomes when you take this and you transfer it to wealth, in the sense of wealth being the ornamental wealth, the large components, the jewelry, the cars. And we've had whether it's, well, I won't name anybody yet, but we've talked about, if you have heard about the prosperity gospel and the idea that there is an obligation by God that if I give so much money, I should get it back tenfold. And oftentimes, in my mind, the element of the prosperity gospel that falls short is it's not referring to the sustaining of you as an individual, your food, your well-being. It is your ornamental wealth and somehow the obligation. I believe it would be an incorrect interpretation of this passage to say it's stating, hey, if I honor God with a gift, then God is obligated to give me more of that ornamental element. This is a promise that if you honor God in that which sustains you, He will continue to provide you with food, with clothing, and with shelter.
Well, I think part of that is because when you go through the process before you actually get a check or you give some payment, the first automatic reflex is, look what I got, buying what's food. And I think the key word in there is honor.
Yeah.
You know, the key is, it's God. He allows you to have part of it, and He wants someone to take care of others.
Yeah.
Take care of them.
Yeah.
Whether it be his priest, or whether it be taking care of him.
Yeah. There was some form in the Old Testament system of a sacrifice, an offering to the Lord, a recognition that it, all that I have comes from Him. And I think He's advocating, even today, we need to find ways to make sure that whatever we possess, whatever we gain, that our first fruits, whatever that may be for us in our mind, we're actually honoring the Lord in that. What we do with it, how we use it, and recognize it. And I agree, the recognition, we have other passages that have us encouraged to recognize that all of what we have is given to us by the Lord. We are mere, what is it, caretakers of it, you know? And we should use it properly for His glory, okay? Sometimes I feel like the government has established itself as the first fruits because before I even get that check, they take their portion out of it, you know? But this is a voluntary. You notice it's not a taxation so much as it is you need to honor by what you do with what you have, okay?
You get into the whole discussion of whether you're giving your tenth.
Yeah, I'm not going there. I think as long as you are honoring God with your first fruits, that is the key. So I won't get into a percentage allocation of what's there. Anybody have any comments on that exhortation for us? We recognize it, okay? The third one He gives us is do not reject the Lord's discipline or loathe His reproof. The reason is, it is an expression of a God who loves and cares about you. Now, when I look at this, one of the commentaries talks about accepting your affliction as a pathway to good. Now, there are two elements here that you need to recognize. There is discipline, and then there's affliction. I think we should make a delineation between the two. Discipline is a loving God who sees a quality in us that is fallen short, and He wants to shape us into the individual He desires for us. He uses the Father as the imagery here, and it's not just a father who has a child, but it's a father who, I'm going to have to look back here to make sure he's right, delights in his child. There's a delight the father has in his child. And the image is a father who delights in his child does not let the child continue on a path that the father knows is destructive or is not good. He wants the child to embrace those very same qualities that he sees as good. Discipline may include punishment, it may include counsel, but the idea, it's a corrective measure to put something back on the right path. That's what discipline's all about. The individual has gotten off the path, moving in the wrong direction. And by the way, when I use path, that ought to ring a bell because we've talked about Proverbs sees life as two paths, two courses, good and evil. And so the discipline of a loving father is that if you have gotten off the path and are heading in the wrong direction, he intercedes and creates environment to draw you back to the right path. But all of us in here should recognize that there are times we are living as we're supposed to, we know that we're doing right, and yet we still suffer some affliction. The error is to do what the Pharisees did when they looked at the blind man outside the temple and said, he's done something wrong, that's why he's blind. And what were Christ's words? No. He has done nothing wrong. He is this way so that God can show you His power and His glory. So that, in a sense, in that illustration, it isn't that the young man had done something wrong in which God was disciplining him to get him back on the right track. It was his affliction was there that God might display His glory. I believe what this passage is talking about, because he's talking to his son, he's encouraging his son that when you get off the right path, don't loathe or reject the discipline of God, because it's lovingly putting you back on the right path. But I also think there are things in our life where we have afflictions that are not based on what we've done, but they are based on the desire for God to display His power and His goodness. And we should be, that discernment element of wisdom helps us understand, is this an action from my loving Father to get me back on the right path? Or is this an affliction I'm going through that God's glory may be displayed? And the discernment is the key, because if you discern affliction in your life that is not based on disobedience or God's discipline to correct you, as that, you will be looking for something you've done wrong when you haven't done anything wrong that's directly related to that affliction. And wisdom has discernment to determine what the truth is in any situation. We know from Paul's letter to the church at Corinth in 2 Corinthians, he indicates to them that there are troubles they will go through, not because they've done anything wrong, but because they will then be able to help others who go through difficult situations and talk about God's passion or compassion and strength to carry them through. So if you live for the Lord passionately, you are going to have affliction and that will come because of discipline, where He's chipping away at the elements in our life that need to be removed. And you're going to have affliction that merely is designed to display His glory in a life that loves Him and honors Him, and you walk through it. And discernment is the key. Okay? Comments or questions or concerns? You're quiet today. Okay. Oh, Arnie, there we go.
Going back to verse 7, do not be wise in your own eyes, but sitting here thinking about our country.
Okay.
Back when I was a young boy and we did the Pledge of Allegiance, we didn't have under God in it. Many of you remember that. And it was inserted. And today there's talk about removing that, as a matter of fact, getting rid of the Pledge of Allegiance altogether. Years ago, there was prayer in school and prayer in our government offices, etc. And now it seems as if we don't need God anymore. Matter of fact, they're getting rather bold in speaking out against what we believe so heartily. And there's a lot of people who are in our public service, I believe, who are kind of wise in their own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just rough for me to deal with.
Yeah,
I find that very difficult. Don't know really how to handle it. They say we can do it with the vote, but they don't give us anybody to vote for.
I can't solve that for you, Arnie. I'm sorry. I'd love to. But it's very true. And I would just state in the simplest and most simplistic manner from Proverbs, there are two paths that we're striving for, the one that is good and understands the Lord and follows His ways, and that which is evil and follows their own way. And I would say that government, when it's wise in its own eyes, is going to be on the path that is not honoring to the Lord. I would say and offer this, that I think in some instances that the Lord, because of the faithful within the country, I think at times the Lord protects us even when the country leadership, we really doesn't deserve it. But He does it for us. He causes things to occur for us. I rest in that.
I'd like to just answer you very quickly, Arnie, if I could. We are really blessed in Texas with a governor who we can trust and who believes the way we do. And I don't know how many of you heard Dan Patrick this morning. Did any of you hear him? speaking about what happened in El Paso and also the other one. But he was speaking from the heart, and just he gave a sermon this morning, and I know the Lord was blessed. So if you get a chance to hear that, maybe you could go online and go back to pull up what he did this morning. It was really great. So we are blessed here in Texas with people that we can vote for.
Thank you.
Two comments. We should not be surprised when fallen men make bad choices. When men who believe in their own wisdom make bad choices, they are actually displaying who they are. It should be more of a shock to us when men who proclaim Christ make bad choices. That would be more shocking because there's been a redeemed component. The other thing I've noticed lately is that when tragedy strikes, whether it be a school shooting or whether it be some other tragedy, I find it interesting that those who deny God all of a sudden wonder where God is. Or those who deny God all of a sudden say, I'm praying for the families. And I can't help but in my head go, who are you praying to? It's a cliche in the culture. It's a kind thing to say that has no basis to it. And so we live in a fallen world. If you know prophecy, you know it's not going to get better. I'm sorry. I wish I had good news for you today. But God is going to allow the evil to continue, those who have chosen that, to continue to just express that until it finally comes to a point when he will address it. He's just going to display it for what it is. And believers, those who call on his name, will be sustained through it, but we're going to experience it. There's going to be things that we will have to, maybe not us in the room, that's, you know, Lord, come quickly, bring us home, keep us out of that. But we do need to know, Scripture does say that the world is not what we trust in, our wisdom is not what we trust in. Follow the path of goodness, and there is sustaining power through the tough times in that path, through that path.
You know, Rob, I think a lot of times, too, when we have coworkers and friends that may not be part of God's family that suffer, it's always interesting to me, especially where I work, that I will have non-believers come to me and ask me to pray for them. And I find that just very an opportunity to witness to them, you know, that we are to stand firm. But I pray that we do give out that light and that love to know, and so consequently, through the Lord allowing it, we are offering a Bible study where I work at lunch at a bank. And I told my boss, I said, well, we're going to open it up to people and just let them know that we're doing this. And I would say, he said, well, how many do you expect? And I said, well, I don't know. I have no idea who the Lord will bring. He said, are you thinking 10 or 12? And we had 41 last week.
Oh, my goodness.
So out of that, my boss went, I mean, and I would say that probably at least a third do not know the Lord. Hmm. So it's, you know, we do have to stand firm, and we do have to be a witness, and we have to work, especially in light of what we're seeing.
That's the epitome of the passage where Christ encourages us at Sermon on the Mount. Let your light so shine that others will look at you and glorify the Father in heaven. You live in such a way that it becomes an attraction. And, you know, when you have a room that's gray, the light is not quite as shining, but when you have a room that's dark, the light really stands out. And you need to, I think that as the world around us begins to decay even more and become more evil, the light will shine even brighter. But we've got to hold to that. If anybody wants to run for office, talk to Arnie afterwards. He'll help you line yourself up.
Arnie, why don't you run?
Sounds like work.
So we see these three exhortations and we see the good reasons. We ought to be able to recognize the principles that are here that still apply to us today. Being wise in our own eyes is not a good path. We need to trust in the wisdom of the Lord. And we will find through that refresh physically. We will experience some physical benefit from that path. The other one is honor God with what we have. He recognize He gives it to us, first fruits, in some manner, make sure that we're recognizing and honoring God as the provider of that. And then we need to accept His discipline. Not like a child who looks at you after you've disciplined them and says, you hate me and I hate you. Oftentimes, little children just see the discipline and think there is no compassion behind it. And here that He's telling us, when the Lord does that, you need to recognize that it is from a loving Father who is guiding you in a path that will bring honor to Him. Okay? Now, the next section is 13 through 20. And this one is really going to focus itself on the true happiness that's found in attaining wisdom. And I know I keep coming back to it, but we need to not lose sight of what wisdom is. We really need to make sure we know that. Wisdom can be one of those terms we throw around, but we don't give it its real punch or its real power through the definition. So remember, we're talking about wisdom is that skillful application, the knowledge of who God is and His precepts, that knowledge, and then the skillful application of that into life. And so when Solomon is talking to his son, he's saying, if you know the Lord and love Him, you know Yahweh and love Him, and you know His precepts, and you seek and grab onto those and you live them out, that's where the true happiness is going to be found. So let me read these verses in 13 through 20. How blessed is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. For her profit is better than the profit of silver, and her gain better than fine gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire compares with her. Long life is in her right hand, and in her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are pleasant ways, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her, and happy are all who hold her fast. The Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, He established the heavens. By His knowledge, the deeps were broken up and the skies drip with dew. Okay, a couple comments here, and then I'll be glad to have you share anything that you've seen. Before we get into these, the element of this is twofold. One is He's going to compare wisdom with the world that you live in. And what do we find mostly that men, women in the world who are not redeemed, what is it that they strive the most for?
Material wealth.
Because in their concept, as they look at the world, if they want security, where are they going to find it? In wealth. It takes away my problems. It means I have everything that I need for every situation. And if I have wealth, what else comes with that that I believe?
Happiness.
Happiness, power, influence. And so in this section, he's going to be taking the concept of wisdom and he is comparing it to what the world says and men seek after, which is wealth, power, possession. He's going to do that. And then at the end, he's going to establish the foundation of it, which is, in my mind, what he's establishing is, even though you look at the world and you think this is the way to get it, the world system is not operating that way. Because it was created with His wisdom. It was created by His wisdom. And I think it's giving us the impression that a system where I believe wealth will provide security, that is not the design of the Creator. And therefore, you won't find it in it. Because the world has been created not to find it that way. Okay? So let's look at these. The elements of happiness, the phrases used in here are blessed, long life, riches, honor, pleasant pathways, and peace. And he's comparing those to gold, silver, jewels, and wealth. If the Lord, I've said this before, if the Lord allows you to find what He can only, what He provides, if He allows you to find it somewhere else, then He's mocked and He lies. So if peace, true peace, can be found somewhere apart from the Lord, then His statement that I am the peace, I am the true peace, would be a lie. So He won't be mocked. The world He created operates in a certain form and fashion, and wisdom aligns itself with that and sees it as truly valuable above what we find in the world. Have any of us in here at times thought that a little bit more money would remove frustration? A lot more money would remove. But it's so true, isn't it? I mean, it's like, if I just could win the lottery, everything would be okay. It wouldn't be. I wish I had excerpts from a show they did years ago that I saw. It was, what happens to those that have won the lottery? And they actually show they're far worse off. There was this momentary excitement that ended in a deeper depression. And I just think, for me, in my mind, I'm going, that's just the nature of God. He's not going to let you find true happiness and true peace. Now, we will run into some who are wealthy, and we will long to have what they have. That's my nature. I wish the car didn't shimmy every time I hit the brakes. And if I just had that Lexus, it wouldn't. Anyway. Okay? So, pleasant pathways and peace. There's the sense that wisdom is the pathway for us to find that true peace and that pleasant pathway. When we are able to find the peace that God offers and truly enjoy it in the way that He gives it to us, we will recognize that money can't buy me that. My possessions can't buy me that. Just as an example of that, my children growing up went to Trinity Christian Academy, and we often joked about the fact that you could see who owned what, whose car was faculty and which ones was students in the parking lot. And you didn't have to, you just had to look at it and you would know. Because the students were in these very nice high-end cars, and the faculty were in these old beaters that were barely holding together. As a side note, I'll just tell you this. This has nothing to do with the lesson. I just remembered it, and I think it's interesting. We had a young lady whose father lived way out in the country. And at that time, Trinity had a vacant field across the street on Sojourn. And so her shuttle to school was a helicopter. Fly her in and dinner, and she would get out and walk across to the thing. We had another student who parents had bought her a very, very nice car, but they didn't want to leave it in the parking lot because the students didn't care for cars like they wanted. And so the servant would ride in the passenger seat while she drove the car to school. Then he would get in and drive it home, and then he would drive it back and get in the passenger, and she would get in and drive it home. So teaching in a school where we found that the income that we had and everything, we were okay, but we were not living to that means. And all that. My kids lived hanging out with people that by world standards were very, very wealthy. And one summer we went to Oregon, and my sister's husband, my brother-in-law, he was in education. And that summer, they went to the grocery store and they pulled their coins together. They pulled their coins together and they bought one thing of ice cream and six or seven spoons. They went in the parking lot and they had ice cream together, and then they created some kind of race, which scared me to death, but some kind of race down a hill in a shopping cart. You know, they got in and would do that. But the thing that amazed me was my kids got in the car when we were getting ready to come home from this vacation up in the Northwest, and they said, "We have never had more fun than this vacation." And it didn't, and they said, "And we didn't have to have money to enjoy life." And so they experienced true joy with their cousins and had a great time without money. But, and I only give you that as an illustration, just in the sense that the pattern in the world is that money or wealth is the path to that happiness. And here he's saying it's not. True peace, true pathways of joy are not found through those things. Okay? And then the other thing is, it's the value of the offer. Profit better than silver, more precious than jewels. Nothing you could desire compares to her. He's just simply saying, whatever you could desire physically in this world that you would want will fall short of wisdom. The peace, the enjoyment, your pathways, the life you will live will be far greater and will provide for you what you may seek elsewhere, but nothing you can desire apart from wisdom will even compare to it. And then I refer to this back that the Lord, by wisdom, created the earth. And the recognition here is that you're striving to look at the world the way the Creator designed it. You're striving to live and understand a life lived in this world the way the Creator designed you to enjoy the world. And we can go back to the Garden of Eden, and if we really understand it, in two things in the Garden of Eden. First off, Adam and Eve were never in want of food, ever. All of their physical needs were taken care of. But greater than that, in my mind, was guess what they got to do at the cool of each day? They got to walk with the Lord in the garden. And you can't buy that, and your wealth won't gain it. And I believe that there's an understanding here, because later on he's going to talk about wisdom is the path to intimacy with God. And that, I believe, is what's being held up here. Being able to walk with the Lord at the cool of the day. Now, we're not talking about prayer. God, in some way, designed it that he was present. They could see him. They could look at him. They could talk to him. And it was a cool walk in a garden, having a conversation with the Creator. How cool is that? And we look forward to that day when he restores his creation back to what he designed it. But in the meantime, the path to experience that to the best we can prior to his return is through the path of wisdom, to enjoy that with the Creator. Comments, questions, concerns?
On the thing of having a lot of money, you also have a lot of responsibility about where you go. Make sure that it doesn't just get thrown out there, just wasted.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of responsibility.
Okay, I think the last section here, it's not the last, I have two sections to go, and the time-wise, let's see if we can look at this one, and then we'll kind of wrap up this one. First off, in 3:21 through 26, and I've stated this one, is that wisdom is always in view and always on the heart. Always in view and always on the heart. Look at verses 21 through 26. My son, let them not vanish from your sight. Keep them in view all the time. Do not let them vanish from your sight. Keep sound wisdom and discretion, so they will be life to your soul and adornment to your neck. Then you will walk in your way securely, and your foot will not stumble. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden fear, nor the onslaught of the wicked when it comes, for the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught. What he's striving at here is to not let wisdom get out of sight. Hold it tight. And basically with that, I believe with wisdom, the understanding of the world you live in and how God applies, how the truth of God applies to that, there's some real simple, very attractive benefits to us. One is, in the dark, I don't find fear. When my enemies are arising, I don't worry about the onslaught because God is my portion. He will protect. Wisdom tells me that. And I'm able to live, even in a tough situation, with a trust. But the other ones that are kind of attractive to me, anyway, is especially that one that says peaceful sleep. That when I lie down and I'm able to close my eyes, I have a sense of trust in the Lord, and I'm not I don't have a fretful sleep because I have confidence. I don't know about you guys, as I get older, that restful sleep is always even more attractive, you know? More attractive. But it's going to hold us in tough times, keep our foot from stumbling, and keep us from being caught. The picture simply is he's calling to his son to hold on to wisdom. Always keep it in view and always have it on your heart. There's great benefit in that. Now remember, wisdom is knowing the precepts of God and knowing how to apply them to life. And therefore, I'm living in harmony with what I know of God and what I know of how to apply it. And then I'm going to experience that even when the enemies are rising, I'm going to find peace, I'm going to find confidence, and I'm going to be able to rest, even in a tough situation. I have that sense of reliance on the Lord. And that's what wisdom leads you to. If you're wise in your own eyes, if I go back to that, if you're wise in your own eyes, the outcome of this is fretful sleep, worrying about your future, uncertain, no confidence, because I'm relying on myself. Okay? Let's hit the last one so we can move on to chapter 4 next time or a little later. 3:27 through 35 is the precepts of how wisdom relates to your neighbor. We should recognize that wisdom is not isolated to myself. There is an expectation of wisdom and how I relate to my neighbor with that. Let me read these. It says, "Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, 'Go and come back, and tomorrow I will give it,' when you have it with you. Do not devise harm against your neighbor when he lives securely beside you, and do not contend with a man without cause if he has done you no harm. Do not envy a man of violence, and do not choose any of his ways, for the devious are an abomination to the Lord, but he is intimate with the upright. The curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked. He blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Through this, though he scoffs at the scoffers, yet he gives grace to the afflicted. The wise will inherit honor, but fools will display dishonor." Couple things here is that in the element as a neighbor, it is basically saying if it is within your power to be gracious to your neighbor, you should be. And you should not delay. Okay? There should be no delay in your good that you do with your neighbor. That comes out of the fact that where he says, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due. There's a sense of responsibility. And there's a sense of responsibility of not saying, I'll do that tomorrow. The procrastination of good. Okay? Do not devise harm against your neighbor. Do not contend with a man without without cause. This is, don't be a quarrelsome individual with your neighbor. It appears to have the element that if you have a cause to contend, if there's a rightful cause, that that's okay. The idea is that you're just quarrelsome and you're contentious, okay? Do not envy a man of violence. This comes out of chapter 1 as well, where he talks about the group that calls you to do evil because there's some benefit from it. He's like, don't latch on to that group. Don't embrace that group. Don't envy that group. The key things out of this is God is intimate with the upright. We give that imagery in the garden, that intimacy that's there. It comes through the path of wisdom. Let's just conclude with this. At the bottom where he says, the wise will inherit honor, but fools display dishonor. If I were to ask you to pull two things out of today's lesson and not forget, one of those is that the path of wisdom leads you to intimacy with God. It talks about him being intimate with the upright. The other thing is wisdom is not just an intellectual conversation. You know what I mean by that? Wisdom is acting. We should never think that wisdom is simply in the mind where you determine and think and ponder that which is good, honorable, and right, and pure. Wisdom is includes with it the application of that in how you live your life. Okay? So remember those two. Intimacy with God is found through the path of wisdom, and wisdom is not just intellectual. Wisdom is calling me to act in a certain way because that is where the upright find honor.